But today I want to explain why it is that we live in the world that we do. And I'm thinking the religious climate that exists in the world. We're part of it. There's a famous statement from Shakespeare, and I guess we're into Shakespeare. This is the third time I've heard something from him spoken today. But he says, "All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. We're being led along. We're being orchestrated." And that's a quote from his play, As You Like It. Winston Churchill said something similar to the U.S. Congress. He said, "There's a plan working out here below." And he was right. But I don't think he really understood that plan. And I'm not sure that we understand that plan to the degree that we ought to. There's a lot written in the Bible that explains God's underlying plan for what he's doing with his creation. God has the intention of saving all of humanity in its time. This is not that time necessarily. We know that by looking around and seeing how many people there are who are interested in becoming converted. It's not necessarily a popular thing with society in general. But in Isaiah 55:6, God says, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways." If we wanted to put together a plan how to open the opportunity for salvation to the majority of people, how would we do it? Would we do it like he does it? I don't think we'd have a clue as to how to bring that about. But there is a plan woven through the words of the Old Testament that carry through to the modern day that explain to us how God is setting up the condition for the salvation of the majority of people who have ever lived. God designated Israel as his model nation. Whatever happened to that? Well, it's still in play, but not in a way that we might think. Under the reigns of King David and Solomon, Israel became a very powerful, a very influential, and a very wealthy nation. But disaster came. It came in between the 6th and the 10th centuries B.C. in the form of the division of the 12 tribes of Israel into two separate nations. It was even in the waning years of King Solomon's reign that God told him what was going to happen. Now, we tend to think of the division of the kingdom as the rebellion of the people, or the rebellion of King Jeroboam, or who became King Jeroboam. Actually, this was God's doing. God wanted that to happen. And there was a purpose for it. He intended that these two nations develop from the peoples of Israel. The kingdom of Israel divided in about 931 B.C. That was about 3,000 years ago. And we should turn to 1 Kings chapter 11, and we'll be there for a little while. But much of the story is contained right there. In 1 Kings 11, let's start about verse 11. It says, "Wherefore the Lord said unto Solomon," he's telling Solomon this while he's still alive, "for as much as this is done of you, and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes which I have commanded you, I will surely rend the kingdom from you, and I will give it to your servant." Jeroboam occupied a high position in the Solomonic reign. He was a prominent person. He was well favored by Solomon. This was not some upstart rebel, okay? He was important in that kingdom. Verse 12, notwithstanding, in your days I will not do it for David your father's sake, but I will rend it out of the hand of your son. That was Rehoboam. However, howbeit, I will not rend away all the kingdom, but will give one tribe to your son for David my servant's sake and for Jerusalem's sake, which I have chosen. God intended the division of the kingdom to happen. In that same chapter, down in about verse 26, it says, and Jeroboam was the son of Nebat, an Ephraimite of Zereda, Solomon's servant. Verse 27, and this was the cause that he lifted up his hand against the king Solomon, built Millo, and reported the breaches of the city to David his father. And the man Jeroboam was a mighty man of valor, and Solomon, seeing the young man, that he was industrious, he made him ruler over all the charge of the house of Joseph. And it came to pass at that time when Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem that the prophet Ahijah the Shilonite found him in the way, and he had clad himself with a new garment, and they two were alone in the field. This is a very important moment in time. And Ahijah caught the new garment that was on him and rent it in 12 pieces. And he said to Jeroboam, take you 10 pieces, for thus saith the Lord God of Israel, behold, I will rend the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon and will give 10 tribes to you. But he shall have one tribe for my servant David's sake and for Jerusalem's sake, the city which I have chosen out of all of the tribes of Israel. Reason given, verse 33, because that they have forsaken me and have worshipped all of these other gods that he names. Verse 34, howbeit I will not take the whole kingdom out of his hand, but I will make him prince all the days of his life, for David my servant's sake, whom I chose, because he has kept my commandments and my statutes. The important thing to notice here is the division of the kingdom was of God. He intended it to happen. And let me say this, it was part of his plan for this situation to develop. And we're going to see the reason for that in just a few minutes here. The reason was, we tend to think it was because the people rebelled against high taxation. It does talk about that. The taxation was pretty heavy, even under Solomon. And they appealed to Rehoboam when he took the kingship. And Rehoboam, in effect, said, nothing doing. My taxing is going to be even heavier than his. And that's part of the reason why the people rebelled and the people went along with this. But that, too, was a setup to facilitate God's plan. God intended this. So even though it appears that the division of the kingdom was political, it actually was religious. We tend to think of the Jewish religion as being pure and authentic throughout history. It was not. They faded from their original religious belief system, began worshiping false pagan gods. They forgot about God's holy days. There was even a period in time when they didn't even know that there was such a thing as a Passover. Can you imagine that? They found the accounts in the trash when they were cleaning out the temple. They read that scroll and they realized there's something here we're not observing. So they reinstituted it. But there was a whole generation where they didn't even know there was such a thing as the Passover. Can you imagine that? So the religion of that time was far from authentic. We shouldn't think of it as being that. And that's part of the motivation of why God had to facilitate his plan. And the breakup of the kingdom was part of that. We tend to fault Jeroboam for being the rebel. It wasn't. This was of God. Now, when they first divided, there was an intent to take up arms and reunify the kingdom. That's what they wanted to do. It was going to be like a civil war, something like we saw in this country, to reunify the nation. And God said, no, nothing doing. He says, this thing is of me. And we find that here in 1 Kings 12. Now, in time, Jeroboam began to realize that those of his kingdom who were going down to Jerusalem from year to year to keep the feasts, he realized that that situation was going to cause some sentiment for reunification. It was going to turn the hearts of his citizens back towards their original affiliation on the basis of religion. He realized that wasn't a good situation. So he set up his own priestly caste. Let's go over to 1 Kings 12. I'm going to start about verse 29. Well, in verse 25, Jeroboam built Shechem in Mount Ephraim and dwelt therein and went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now shall the kingdom return to the house of David if this people go up to do sacrifice in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem. Then shall the heart of this people turn again to their Lord, even unto Rehoboam, the king of Judah, and they shall kill me and go again to Rehoboam, king of Judah. He was concerned that the religious connection would create sentiment for reunification. So he went and set up his own priestly caste in his own country and set up other cities to be the center of religious worship. And that was the important thing. Again, that had a long-term effect that we don't realize that extends to the modern day. The thing of it is, the long-term effect of this division was useful in God's plan for humanity. We may not realize that. What God was doing is he set up a situation that ultimately led to a religious or cultural environment in the world more amenable to accepting Christianity. Think about that. If you were to bring Christianity to the Jewish world of that day, what would happen? Well, we see what happened. Okay? Was there widespread acceptance? No. They grabbed him, gave him a false trial, and they killed him. Their own Messiah. They killed him. Did God intend for that to happen? It did because he knew their hearts. He knew their hearts. And that facilitated part of his plan, because if he wasn't killed when he was, we would be living in a very different world. And not only then, but at the right day. He was our Passover. He was killed on Passover. But it had to be in the hearts of those people to respond the way they did. God knew their hearts. Was it a setup? Was it of his doing? That's what we need to realize. This was not against God's will. It was part of the plan. The northern 10 tribes were conquered by Assyria. And this is after they had been a separate nation for like 236 years. They were taken into captivity. They were deported. They were taken up into the southern Caucasus regions between the Black and Caspian Seas, where we kind of lost track of where they went from there. But there is a track. We'll check it out here. But they were taken captive, and they were never brought back to the land. Now, Babylon succeeded Assyria. When the Assyrian Empire was in full force, Babylon was a province within Assyria. In time, the Babylonians gained the ascendancy, and they turned and conquered Assyria and became the Babylonian Empire. Same people, same region. We tend to think of them as two entirely different nations. They're pretty much the same people. It's just a matter of who was in power at the time. But what had been Assyria was assimilated by the Babylonian Empire. Keep in mind, in that region, there was this succession of powers. It began with Assyria, then became Babylon, followed by Medo-Persia. Alexander the Great went through the area, conquered the whole region, but then died after a very short time. And he left his empire to the Seleucids, one of his generals. But after that, the same region was dominated by the empire of Parthia. You don't hear much about Parthia in the world today. You probably never heard of it in school. Here was a power equal to Rome, and nobody teaches it. Not in churches, not in academia. You never hear of Parthia. They ruled the area for 500 years. They were the longest of the empires to dominate the Mesopotamian region. Their empire stretched from western India clear up to the eastern boundary of the Roman Empire. It was a huge area and encompassed all of Mesopotamia, that upper part of the Fertile Crescent. They were a powerful people, but we don't know much about them. Well, the northern kingdom was taken captive by Assyria in 732 BC. And the deportations went on there for the next decade or so. But the southern kingdom, what we know as the House of Judah, never reformed their religion prior to their captivity, which came about 145 years later in 586 BC. The Jewish nation was taken captive by and to Babylon, but they were allowed to return to their homeland. They were held captive for a generation or a couple of generations, for about 70 years, and then they returned to the land, reoriented religiously, and restructured. They went through what we could call a reformation, which brought them back to the original religion that they should have been practicing all along. Now, there's something I want to pose to you, and think about this. It may make sense in time, it may not at first. But I'm going to suggest that there is a component in various ethnicities, a component within people's psyche that account for their religious preferences. Different ethnicities embrace, rather solidly, religious belief systems particular to their culture. For example, the Muslim religion pervades throughout the Arabic world. Right next to the Jewish communities. And those two do not blend. So that tells us this is ethnic, not just regional. There's a component there that we need to recognize because it helps us to understand the world condition as we see it. Various ethnic populations all over the world oftentimes are heavily oriented to a particular religious belief system. If I were to mention Hinduism, we would sort of think of a region of the world. We would sort of think of an ethnicity that embraces that. Buddhism, we know where the Buddhists live. Even if there was a Buddhist amongst us, we would recognize their ethnic origin simply by the basis of their religious preference. Shintoism, the Islamic world, the Christian world. There are all of these regions that are generally ethnic in their composition. How does that happen? Why does it happen? Does God have anything to do with it? Would it be an illogical thing for me to say that the ethnic descendants of the tribes of Israel might exhibit similar preferences? I'm saying it's like there's a spiritual predilection embedded in the human psyche. And what is a predilection? Well, you can sort of see a contraction of the word, a predetermined election. What we would tend to do, maybe unconsciously, we would have a preference. A predilection is a preference. It's something we're drawn to, not necessarily by any conscious decision. Does that exist in the human world? Well, think about the Tower of Babel and the confusion of languages. Here they were, all working together, all speaking the same language, busy as bees, building this tower. They were going to challenge God. They're going to rise up to the heavens. Until one day, they woke up. They couldn't understand each other. This group spoke that language, that group spoke that one, another group spoke that one. God put it in their minds. He created these new languages. They had nothing to do with it. He put a whole different language structure into people's minds. And they're speaking it, thinking they were speaking the same as they ever were. It's kind of like the reverse thing that happened in the day of Pentecost with the changing of languages between the speaker and the hearer. The opposite thing happened. God put it in the psyche or the mental structure of those people to all begin speaking different languages. Think about that. Can the same thing be happening ethnically with major population segments? It kind of seems to be because that's what we see in the world. Is there a spiritual predilection among various ethnicities? Because if there is, I'm going to pose to you something. This is perhaps novel. But I'm going to say that perhaps we can trace the 12 tribes of Israel by their religious preferences. Okay. One thing we know, they do have one. If you were to meet a Jewish person who is ethnically Jewish, whether they're religious or not, we would know what part of the world that they grew from. We would know their ethnicity simply by their religious preference. Can we say the same thing for the 10 tribes? Okay. Let's think about the contrast between Jewish people and Christian people. And where do we find Christian people for the most part? What is their point of origin? Granted, there's Christians all over the world. Well, there's Jews all over the world, too. But what was their original persuasion? What was their original ethnicity? That's what we need to think about. There's talk of a thing called the Judeo-Christian ethic. And that sort of tells us there's a connection that exists between these two peoples. It's not the same religion at all. But there's a certain commonality. Ethics, not necessarily straight line beliefs. There's times when the true Christian religion is called too Jewish. We can understand that. If someone were to worship God the way the Bible says, strictly, to some people that would be too Jewish for their tastes. The early church was eventually referred to as a sect, and we can read of that in Acts 28, where it says, "But we desire to hear of you what you think. For as concerning this sect, we know that everywhere it is evil spoken against." At first, the Christians, or the people that God was working with, his apostles in the early church, was considered a branch of the Jewish faith. At first, maybe it was. But they went on to develop other concepts. They embraced other ideas that would not have been well received in the Jewish environment. They developed their own distinct character and belief system. But the interconnection that we need to understand is rooted in the greater kingdom of Israel. And by that I mean all 12 tribes. Let's move into a new area that we see in the New Testament. There's evidence there. Jesus' ministry and teachings among the Jewish religious culture were largely unreceptive. It says in John 1:11, "He came to his own, and his own received him not." And I spoke on that back last July, I think, on a message called Embracing Judaism, where we looked at the different receptive environments between the Judeans, the Samaritans, and the Galileans. They weren't all the same in their reaction or the reception to the teachings of Jesus and his apostles. All of his apostles were Galileans, probably for good reason. Only Paul was a Judean, and look what it took to change his persuasion. Paul was the apostle to the Gentiles. Do you think he could have been an effective apostle to the Jews? They hated him. They wanted to kill him. He was one of theirs and one of the elites of the Jewish community. But he was converted. Didn't set well in the Jewish culture of the day. We should also look at what commission Jesus gave to his apostles, where he told them to go preach to the lost tribes of Israel. James, in his greetings, sent his epistle to the 12 tribes scattered abroad. That's in the very first verse of his book. The 12 tribes scattered abroad. That tells us they knew where they were. They weren't lost to God's awareness, even though society may have forgotten who they were. Amos 9:9 tells us something about that. And this is where God says, "For lo, I will command and I will sift the house of Israel among all nations, like as corn is sifted in a sieve, yet shall not the least grain fall upon the earth." And that's primarily what happened with the northern 10 tribes. That didn't happen with the Jewish community so much. It was the 10 tribes that were sifted among the nations. It's important to keep that in mind. The various Israelite tribes and their religious environments are what bring us to the present day situation. After all, we identify the descendants of the kingdom of Judah primarily by their religious preference. Can't we say the same thing for the 10 tribes? Have we thought about that? The fact of the northern kingdom not being returned, they were long exposed to a different religious environment, as were their southern counterparts. That exposure shaped their cultural belief system and their attitude towards religion in general. Not only what they believed, but their approach to religious development. Because as we know, in time, religions evolve. They gain some things, they lose some things. But it was the attitude of the 10 tribes towards the religious environment in which they lived. While we thought the northern 10 tribes left the original faith, not entirely. Not entirely. They kept a certain degree of consciousness. Evidence being the Magi. They made that long, arduous trek, almost 600 miles, to Jerusalem to acknowledge the birth of Jesus. How did they know that? They knew about the Messiah and where he would come from. Acts 2, for example, and Isaiah 9. And we read in Acts 2 of the predominance of Parthian worshipers. They're listed first. Regularly attending the holy days at the temple in Jerusalem. That attests to the fact of the affinity for the Parthians to the religious teachings that were still being observed in Jerusalem. At that time, that was the closest thing to God's religion there was. But things were developing. And God had to have prepared an environment where his teachings and his truth would gain acceptance, knowing that it would not gain acceptance in and among his own ethnicity. He came to his own. And his own received him not. Do you think he would have known that that was going to be the situation? Of course. Of course. Now think about the Parthians coming to Jerusalem to worship. This was some 770 years after the 10 tribes were taken captive. So they preserved an element of their belief system clear through to that time. So we shouldn't necessarily think of them as pagans or compromised. They believed some of the things that were written in the law, but not to the degree that their southern brethren did. There isn't a lot of dispute that the Jewish ethnicities, those who descended from the house of Judah, are inclined to embrace the Jewish religion. Could the same be the case with the 10 tribes of Israel as well? What is their religious predilection? If the 10 tribes had a religious preference, what would it be? Not Orthodox Judaism. There may be elements of it in there. Think back to that phrase, the Judeo-Christian ethic. There's elements embedded in the Ten Tribes religious system, but not the same, of course, as the others. We know from prophecy that the ethnic house of Israel is not extinct. You would think so if you listen to some people in this world, the lost ten tribes, we don't know who they are, they're all gone, they don't exist anymore, depending on who you listen to. The house of Israel is not extinct. We have proof of that. We can look at Revelation chapter 7 and chapter 14 to know that for sure. There will be an identifiable ethnicity at the time of Christ's second coming. He is going to gather out 12,000 from each of those tribes to work with him, to be part of the administration of the government, initially of Israel, but of the whole world, when God opens his plan of salvation to all of the rest of humanity. God intended Israel to be a model nation, but they blew it and have done so clear up to the present time. You couldn't look to Israel today, either the two tribes or the ten, as being the model that God would want to project to the whole world. But he has prepared a people with which he can do that. Not a huge number, a relatively small number, the size of a rather small town, 144,000 people. He is going to select to be the rulers, 12,000 each, over each of the 12 tribes of Israel. So that tells us the 12 tribes are still in existence as far as God knows. We may not, but he knows. And he knows who his people are. We talked about the commission that God gave to his disciples and apostles regarding taking the gospel to the world. Now, another thing we need to consider is the use of the word or the term King of the Jews. Was Jesus King of the Jews? Did he ever call himself that? Actually, not. The term King of the Jews is used 17 times, and just in the four Gospels. The King of the Jews was used strictly by the Magi, or Herod responding to what the Magi said, but mostly by Pilate, used in Jesus' trial and crucifixion. We don't find where Jesus referred to himself as King of the Jews except once in response to Pilate's accusation. The term that Jesus himself espoused was King of Israel. What's the difference? King of Israel is the inclusive term. King of the Jews is an exclusive term. That involved just the two tribes, the southern house of Judah. He told his disciples, he said, go to the lost tribes of Israel. He said of himself in Matthew 15:24, but he answered and said, I am not sent, but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Key words there, lost. The Jewish nation wasn't lost. Everybody knew where it was to this day. He's talking about those that are no longer in the area. And he's saying, I'm not sent to my own ethnicity. I'm sent to the ten tribes, which were a different ethnicity entirely. Those two nations separated 3,000 years ago. And they went on to develop their own ethnic generations. The house of Israel, the 10 tribes, were never Jews. The Jews is the name that was given to the tribes of Judah, the kingdom of Judah. There are different people. We need to understand that. The world doesn't understand it. They don't recognize the distinction between Judah and Israel. But he says, I am not sent, but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel. This suggests his real ministry was to others than those of his own ethnic tribe. He wasn't sent to convert the Jews, not at that time. There's a time for them, but not just then. Look at how they reacted. Rage, outrage. They wanted to kill him. And they were successful in God's time and for his own reasons. Now he told his own apostles in Matthew 10:6, he says, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, reflecting his own commission. Go rather. The word rather tells us that they might have had a different idea at first, but he was sending them somewhere else. That would suggest that they leave off what they were intending to do and take on a different commission. Now, as to this King of the Jews, King of Israel thing, even the detractors of his own day, even while he was on the cross, they used a different term. Notice what they said. It's Matthew 27:42. He said, he saved others. This is what the people on the ground are saying. He saved others. Himself, he cannot save. If he be king of Israel, let him now come down from the cross, and we will believe him. Similar account in Mark 15:32. And this was probably a different witness because it was uttered differently. But that one said, let Christ, the King of Israel, descend now from the cross, that we may see and believe. This speaks to the common term that was being used among the people in that day. A disciple, Nathanael, in responding to Jesus' call, said this. And that's in John 1:49. Nathanael answered and said unto him, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. That's the term that's used in the entirety of the New Testament, with the exception of the references that we saw from Pilate or Herod or the Magi. The point is, they were, by this instruction, to be sent to the 10 tribes. Now there's an interesting comment in Acts 1:6. It says, when they were therefore come together, they asked him, saying, Lord, will you at this time restore again the kingdom to Israel? Now we have intended in the past, we have been inclined to think of that referring to throwing off Roman rule. Throwing off Roman rule would not have effected the reunification of the two houses. They were talking about the reunification that you read of in Ezekiel 37. That's different. But the reunification of the 12 tribes is prophesied. Now we can look at Paul's commission. This is an interesting statement. But the Lord said unto him, go your way, for he, referring to Paul, is a chosen vessel unto me to bear my name before Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel. That's in Acts 9:15. Jesus is making an important distinction that there's an ethnicity that isn't Gentile, yet isn't Jewish either. Paul was not the apostle to the Jews. We know that. He was the apostle to others than the Jews. But there's Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel as distinct from Gentiles. There is an ethnicity that is unique to the children of Israel. In Hebrews 8, verses 8 through 10, talks about the new covenant that is to come. For finding fault with them, the people, he said, "Behold, the days come, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, says the Lord, I will put my laws into their mind and write them in their hearts. And I will be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people." That, of course, is a repetition of another passage in the Old Testament. But here again, there's a subtlety that we may not well recognize. The covenant that's prophesied to be restored is inclusive of both houses of Israel. The fault referred to wasn't limited to the time of the wilderness years. That's where the original covenant was made. Significant faults were seen in the kingdom of the 8th century BC that precipitated the division. The two houses were taken captive separately. Why wouldn't God take them into captivity together as a whole nation? Why break them up and take them into captivity separately, separated by some 145 years? There's a reason for that. And in that, we see a glimpse into God's plan. They became exiled by different conquerors, different cultures. One house was restored to their former lands, but the other was not. The reason for that, one that we might not have seen. The Judahites came out of their captivity reformed. But then a problem developed. They developed a very hard line in their traditions. So hard that they had a problem accepting salvation by grace through faith. That was the underlying message of the Christian religion. They didn't respond well to that. God had to divide these people in order to create an environment where his message and his person could be accepted. The Jewish world didn't accept their own Messiah. They killed him. Granted, it was part of God's plan, his purpose. But he had to prepare a world environment or a religious environment that would be accepting of what he was going to bring to them. And that's the important thing to understand about the division of the whole house of Israel. A people were being prepared. A people who would be more receptive. The peoples of the house of Israel, the northern kingdom. What would happen if Jesus had left the development of the New Testament to the Jewish community of the time? Can you imagine that? What would our Bibles look like today? Okay? They would have put their stamp on it. According to their cultural orientation. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying they weren't ready at that time. And I'll explain why in a few minutes. God had to break from the Hebrew culture in order to facilitate a more accurate representation of Christianity's precepts. This was the religious environment among the exiled tribes. their response was different. While they retained a familiarity with their old covenant religious culture, they kept only a vestige of it. What we need to realize is the predominant religion in the Mesopotamian region in the day of Jesus was Zoroastrianism. And we hear that term, we think, oh, rank pagans. Were they really? If you look into the religion of the Zoroastrians, it's kind of surprising because you realize that embedded in their belief system is many things that we find in Christianity today. It's just astounding. Let me read this passage, and this is from the internet. Zoroastrian is the Iranian religion and one of the world's oldest faiths, based on the teachings of the Iranian-speaking prophet Zoroaster from about 500 BC. It has a dualistic cosmology of good and evil within the framework of a monotheistic ontology and an eschatology which precedes the ultimate conquest of evil by good. Zoroastrianism exalts an uncreated and benevolent deity of wisdom known as Ahura Mazda, literally Lord of Wisdom, as its supreme being. Historically, the unique features of Zoroastrianism, such as its monotheism, messianism, belief in free will, judgment after death, conception of heaven, hell, angels, and demons, among other concepts, may have influenced other religious and philosophical systems, including the Abrahamic religions, those being Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. Those are the Abrahamic religions. So the Parthians were not necessarily rank pagans. It's important to realize that. They were prominent in the region, particularly in the time of Christ, which is about the midpoint of their reign as an empire, which lasted 500 years. They were driven out of the area in about 224 A.D., driven across the Caucasus Mountains to the north and to the west, like the prophecies say. They became known, because of the Caucasus Mountains region, they became known as Caucasians. Where did that term come from? There's only one region in the world that's called that. And that's the area where they were originally exiled by Assyria. Now, I remember in grade school, where they're talking, this is an English class, where they're talking about the origins of our English language. And it was said that German and English were Indo-Iranian languages. What does that have to do with us today? India? We know where India is. We know where Iran is. Well, that was the region that was dominated by the nation of Parthia. So the Parthians were driven through the Caucasus mountain regions up into Europe, where basically the 10 tribes are today. We've known that for a long time. That's one thing that's unique about the Church of God, is we have understood who the modern descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel are. And we do so unashamedly, under a lot of criticism, perhaps. But what I'm saying to you is that the characteristic or the acceptability of Christian teachings found acceptance in the 10 tribes. No, their religion was not the true religion of God, but it created an environment to where true Christianity could exist. If you took true Christianity and tried to sell it in the Islamic world, what do you think would happen? Or in the Buddhist world, what kind of acceptance would you expect? There's only one ethnicity, there's only one region of the world where Christianity took root with the enthusiasm that it did. And that was among the peoples who trace their origins to the 10 tribes that were separated from the whole house of Israel by God back in the 900s BC. God was preparing a people. He was preparing a people to facilitate his plan to bring salvation to the world. He created a religious environment among the exiled tribes that was different from their ethnic brethren. Now, that in mind, that helps us to understand some prophecies or some statements in the New Testament, where we understand that the peoples of the southern kingdom are going to be called and converted in their time. Let's breeze through a few of these. Ephesians 4:18. Having the understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God through the ignorance that is in them because of the blindness of their heart. Who's that speaking to? That was speaking to the Judaic world of the day. John 12:40. He has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart that they should not see with their eyes nor understand with their heart and be converted, and I should heal them. Is this a bias against those people? It is and it isn't. Because it's part of God's plan to call them, but to call them at the proper time and in the environment where they can be most successful in their quest for conversion and eternal life. Romans 11:31-32. Even so have these also now not believed, that through your mercy they also may obtain mercy. For God has concluded them all in unbelief, that he might have mercy upon all. Do we understand what that's telling us? He's closing out a certain ethnicity, a certain religious belief system at the present time for an ultimate purpose later on. God is going to call all who have ever lived. And he wants to do it in such a way that he gets the maximum return for his efforts. The problem with those people we find in Mark 7:9. And he said unto them, full well you reject the commandment of God, that you may keep your own tradition. Their own religious traditions preempted God's commandments. In John 12:38-40, that the saying of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spoke, Lord, who has believed our report? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Therefore, they could not believe, because that Isaiah again said, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, that they should not see with their eyes, nor understand with their heart, and be converted, and I should heal them. That's very profound. It's hard to accept that. It's hard to believe that, except knowing that there is a time coming when he will have incredible mercy on those people at the right time, in the right environment, when they can accept the religion of the new covenant. 2 Corinthians 3:14-15, but their minds were blinded, for until this day remains the same veil untaken away in the reading of the Old Testament. which veil is done away in Christ. But even unto this day, when Moses is read, the veil is upon their hearts. They don't even fully understand their own original texts. Another problem, of course, is their refusal to accept their Messiah. Because to accept him, they have to accept another thing that they will not accept. And that's the idea of a dual person Godhead. They are strict monotheists. That means they accept a single person God only. But the major teaching of the New Testament is the introduction of the Son of God, who was fully God. That just didn't fly in that environment. But they had other problems too. Acts 23 verse 8 says, "For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees confess both." Now that kind of reflects on what I just read about who the Parthians were and what they believed. Because they did accept those things. But my point is, God created an environment among the peoples of Israel who would be far more amenable to accepting the teachings of the new covenant than would have been accepted in the southern kingdom, the house of Judah. It's part of God's plan. That division was important. He created it. This was of him. We may not think so. But here's what I'm telling you. God is revealing his plan in subtle ways that we wouldn't necessarily notice. He created an environment among the 10 tribes of Israel that would be amenable to accepting his messiahship and his new covenant teachings. That's the bottom line of all of this. And what I'm telling you is we can, in part, identify the 10 tribes by their religious preference, just like we can identify the Jews from theirs. God has a plan. He intends to convert all of humanity in their proper season. So that's the message I want to give to you. And hopefully it'll make more sense to understand the world that we live in today, the religious climate that exists today, knowing that God is fully in charge. He's set this up. He's made it happen. And it's part of what he intends to do. God is not willing that any should perish, but he has a plan where that can be accomplished in a most spectacular way. And those that he is calling now are going to be part of his 144,000 to be the leaders in the world to come.